take a seat, and let's begin. Today, we're back for part two of our deep dive into the bizarre and unnerving world of the Satanic Panic. If you thought things were strange last time, just wait until you hear what we've got in store for you today. Picture this, a quaint little town, the kind of place where everyone knows everyone, but under the surface, fear is bubbling up, turning whispers into accusations and neighbors into suspects. In today's episode, we're heading into the thick of it with the infamous County Walk case and the tragic story of Peter Ellis. What started as concerned parents looking for answers quickly spiraled into a frenzy of outlandish claims and the ruin of innocent lives. Were there really dark forces at play, or was it all just a product of collective hysteria? We'll uncover how a daycare center became ground zero for one of the most shocking cases of mass paranoia, and how one man, Peter Ellis, found himself at the center of it all. So grab your magnifying glass, because we're peeling back the layers of this twisted tale to see what really went down in County Walk. Ready to dive into the madness? Let's go. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right. So, part two of Satanic Panic.
Electric Boogaloo.
So.
Huh?
You ever heard that?
Part two, Electric Boogaloo.
No.
It's okay.
Well.
You're in it now.
Okay, so. Let's jump right into it. So, Frank Fuster, also known as Francisco Fuster Escalona, and his wife, Ileana Flores.
I would have gone with Francisco, personally.
Yeah. Operated the Country Walk babysitting service in the Country Walk suburb of Miami, Florida.
Your neighborhood.
God, no. Don't ever say that. Just like Canada's yours.
Okay, point taken.
It's the exact same thing.
Okay.
Nobody wants to be associated with Miami because it's a shithole. And if you live in Miami, you understand. Because I fucking hate Miami. Miami is the Brooklyn of Florida.
Ugh,
yeah. Fuster had a criminal history, including a 1969 conviction for the manslaughter of Jacob Eisenbeck. In 1980, Fuster was shot in the head, which his family claimed led to significant personality changes. I would say so. In 1981, he was convicted of fondling a 9-year-old child, a charge he denied despite being convicted and initially sentenced to 2 years of probation. Fuster later expressed regret for not taking the stand in his defense during the 1981 trial, a decision made on the advice of his lawyer. His defense team in the Country Walk case believed that his earlier convictions were justified. Despite his criminal record, Fuster's probation officer approved his employment at a daycare. In 1985, Fuster was charged and convicted of 14 counts of child sexual abuse related to his work at the daycare. He was sentenced to a minimum of 165 years in prison. The victims testified that Fuster's led them in quasi-satanic rituals and intimidated them by forcing them to watch as Fuster mutilated birds, warning the children not to reveal the abuse.
What the fuck?
The child witnesses in the case were questioned by University of Miami child psychologists Lori and Joseph Braga, whose interviewing techniques were later criticized as coercive. The Bragas reportedly questioned the Fuster's son for 7 hours, leading critics to label them as the Pied Pipers of child abuse. However, the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit dismissed arguments that these alleged coercive methods were relevant to the case. The court ruled that the issue had been fully addressed during the original trial, where the defense had cross-examined the Bragas and presented an expert witness, Dr. Lee Coleman, who discussed potential problems with interviewing children. Additionally, the appeals court noted that the parents of several children who attended Fuster's babysitting service testified that their children exhibited severe behavioral and physical issues shortly after attending the service, even before they were interviewed, which is very common in sexual assault cases, especially of children. The case against Frank Fuster took a significant turn when his wife, Ileana, accused him of sexually abusing their 6-year-old son, Noel. As part of the investigation, Noel was administered a throat culture test, which indicated the presence of gonorrhea. However, critics have pointed out that the test was relatively new and allegedly unreliable, as it could not distinguish gonorrhea from other microbes commonly found in both children's and adults' throats. The test was said to have a false positive rate in children of over 1/3. Complicating matters further, the prosecution destroyed the test sample, preventing any possibility of a retest. Despite these concerns, the 11th Circuit Court in 2006 dismissed Fuster's objections to the gonorrhea test, noting that he did not raise a specific constitutional objection and did not argue that his son's test results were actually negative. The court further stated that the gonorrhea test merely corroborated other evidence suggesting that Fuster had sexually abused his son.
Hmm.
So he never denied it. He just denied the use of the test.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. He's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
The positive gonorrhea test seemed to convince the prosecution of the Fuster's guilt, leading them to seek a confession from Ileana. Attorney Michael von Zanft, who initially represented both Frank and Ileana, dropped Frank as a client and allegedly worked to help Ileana recover memories of abuse. Critics have noted that Von Zamp's role shifted from being Francisco's defender to effectively acting as his prosecutor. The prosecution, with Von Zamp's assistance, brought in a group known as the Behavior Changers to extract a confession from Ileana. Sounds like a CIA black op.
Yeah. And I'm...
We're going to get the answers out of you.
I am noting that is a bit of an ethical dilemma. I mean, Zamp isn't Frank's lawyer, but he does have a conflict. It seems like a conflict of interest. I think he should have probably dropped both because.
Yeah, but what would you have done if you found out your client sexually abused their kid? You would have wanted to prosecute them if you were morally ambiguous.
You're right, especially
if you have a connection with them already.
I'm just saying, from a lawyer ethnic point of view, if you find, they always, from what I've always been told, if you ever find yourself in an ethical dilemma, you're supposed to just step away from the whole situation because.
But that's now. That wasn't back then.
Oh, it was back then. I mean, the rules haven't changed. It's just their interpretation enforcement has.
Yeah. Ileana later described the methods used by the behavior changers in 2001, explaining that they would tell her stories of the alleged abuse and have her close her eyes and imagine the events as they narrated them. If she made mistakes, they would correct her and have her repeat the process until she, quote unquote, remembered the supposed events. This process of guided imagery and repeated suggestions led her to eventually recover, quote unquote, the memories that the prosecution was seeking.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I'm sure even back then this sounded to use the kids, the vernacular the kids are using today. This looked hella sus, probably even back then. Shut up, right? It's not my fault this generation of youngsters can't articulate the English
language. Skibbity toilet.
I don't know. But all the same, I'm pretty sure this was highly.
Oh, yeah.
It's
highly illegal.
Even back then.
In 1985, after undergoing this treatment, Ileana gave a deposition against Frank, during which she provided detailed accounts of abuse, including bizarre elements such as snakes and feces.
Yeah, it got...
During her deposition, she was periodically interrupted and guided by Michael Rapaport, the actor? Isn't that the actor, Michael Rapaport? Comedian? Of the behavior changers, with Janet Reno also present.
Yeah, Janet Reno is also the former attorney general under Bill Clinton. She's also was the head prosecutor for these cases, a bunch of cases actually.
Janet Reno has no negative things about her.
No, she wasn't responsible for Waco at all. Oh, sorry, did I say that out loud?
Yeah.
Or Ruby Ridge. Oops, another Freudian slip.
Yeah, which we will talk about next season because we're going to be redoing all of those.
Yeah.
Sociologist Richard Offshay, who studied the case, later testified that Ileana had been repeatedly hypnotized before the trial. and that her high suggestibility combined with a strong desire to please made her testimony likely to include many elements suggested to her by therapists. She concluded that her testimony could not be considered reliable or factual. Despite these concerns, Ileana did not admit to being coerced when she pled guilty, instead maintaining that she was innocent but wanted to get all of this over. She served 3 years in prison, during which she divorced Frank and became a born-again Christian, just like Son of Sam.
Allegedly.
After her release, Ileana was deported to Honduras, accompanied by members of her new church. The Fusters lost custody of their son, Noel, who did not testify during the trial. Noel went to live with his biological mother and her husband, and later denied that he had been abused. Because of his denial, Noel did not receive any portion of the settlements, totaling over $5 million. Boy, you should have just admitted that, even if it was fake.
Jesus.
Paid by the Disney-owned Arvida Corporation, developers of the Country Walk community, to the families of the alleged victims of the case.
Yeah.
Country Walk doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, Disney had this weird thing back in the 80s where they, like, tried to, like, build communities.
They still exist.
Yeah.
There's one in Orlando just outside of Disney.
It's really weird. Like, it's very bizarre
how they did it. They're all self-sustaining communities, usually wealthier people. They have their own shopping centers. They have their own grocery stores, gas stations. You literally do not have to leave to do anything. There's another one. Disney doesn't own it, but there's another one in Orlando that we actually passed by when you guys went there that has a school too. And they built a tunnel underneath the highway so the kids could go to school and walk to school without being hit by cars.
Well, that's actually pretty smart of them. But
and it's a very, like, it starts out at $300,000.
Yeah, Disney was, like, all about that in the 80s. I think it was whatever Walt Disney's brother, he was the one in charge at the time. He started some of these communities. Almost all of them, the flagship one, it failed. Like, they started getting crime, and they started, and the news was all over them. Like, just nothing was anything typically abnormal about it. It was just the fact that it was at a Disney-run town.
Yeah, like,
oh my God, suicide at Disney World town.
You can live right now in Golden Oak. And then they just did Story Living as their new one. And then they're planning on building like 4 or 5 more. The biggest one is Celebration.
Mm.
So Celebration is actually a town owned by Disney. And if you live in Celebration, it's a suburb of Orlando. And it was originally developed by Disney. I think Orlando itself owns it now. But Celebration is the one that I know. But it's very expensive. Mm. Like, Celebration, you're looking at $500,000 to start out for the houses.
It's not the same to get into Disney World these days.
So, Ileana Fuster initially offered testimony against her husband, Frank Fuster, after pleading guilty but before being sentenced. However, she later recanted her court testimony, claiming she had been kept naked in solitary confinement and then subjected to various forms of physical and psychological duress until she agreed to testify against him. Defense investigator Steven Dinerstein corroborated this, describing how Ileana was reportedly hosed down in her cell, often kept nude, and constantly exposed to view. To the view? I'd give up listening to them, too.
Yeah, same.
Listening to friggin'
Whoopi Goldberg
talk, I'd shoot myself. Ileana also told Frontline that prosecutor Janet Reno visited her in jail, allegedly pressuring her to testify by saying, "I'm sorry, but you are not innocent. You are going to have to help us." The exact number of Reno's visits is disputed, with some sources claiming at least 30 visits alongside 34 interrogations by Michael Rappaport of the Behavior Changers. These interrogations have been described as tantamount to psychological torture, with defense witness Ralph Underwager comparing them to the torture of American prisoners of war during the Korean War. I would not put it past Janet Reno to do that.
There was a lot of this.
She's a shady bitch.
A lot of this was covered up after Bill Clinton won the election and he appointed Janet Reno. There were some efforts to try and introduce this, but, well, the Clinton machine went into overdrive and, well, what old Billy Boy wants, he gets. And he wanted Janet Reno as his attorney general. And he got her as the attorney general.
Do you know what Janet Reno looks like?
Looks like a lady.
That's Janet Reno.
Dude, looks like
a lady. I should put Janet Reno as our picture for this. That's going to be our thumbnail for this. Is Janet Reno. She died in 2016.
Good. I'm sorry, but she was shady as hell, and I would not be surprised if half of all the shady stuff the Clintons did while they were in office were covered up by her in the Justice Department.
Yeah, she was, like, even back in the day, like, when she first became the state attorney, yeah, she was in charge of drug court and all of that.
She came up with something that I looked up. I didn't put it in here because it was a little bit long and it kind of detracted from what we were doing. But it was called the Miami Method. Basically, it's described as a very coercive tactics in order to basically get a conviction. It's not something any prosecutor, any lawyer should try to emulate, because half of it is borderline illegal, if not illegal. It's definitely ethically dubious at best.
Yeah. She died in 2016 of Parkinson's.
That's a bad way to go.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, we don't miss her.
No.
When Michael Von Zampf dropped Frank Fuster as a client, Fuster was left with the defense attorney Jeffrey Samick. Fuster claimed that after his 1981 conviction, Samick intended to handle his appeal but found no grounds for it, which Fuster argued prevented him from filing an appeal on time. During the 1985 trial, tensions escalated between Fuster and Samick, with Fuster accusing Samick of lying and Samick accusing Fuster of assault. Mm-hmm. Despite requests from both parties for Samick to be replaced, the judge denied these requests. Very common if you're in the middle of a case. If you go to the beginning of the case and you say, hey, I want to drop my attorney, I want a new attorney, then that'll typically happen. But if you're in the middle of the case, they're not going to dismiss it unless something drastic happens. Fuster later admitted to physically confronting Samick by pushing him against a wall. When Fuster was convicted, Samick remarked on the presumption of guilt that seemed to accompany such charges, though he did not explicitly state that this applied to Fuster's case. Dinerstein, the defense investigator, later complained that Fuster's defense lawyers were uninterested in pursuing exculpatory evidence, refusing to meet with him when such information was discovered. Fuster's appeal on the grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel was rejected because it was not filed in a timely manner. In 1995, Ileana Fuster, then living in Honduras, gave a deposition to Arthur Cohen, an appeals lawyer representing Frank, in which she stated she could not remember any child abuse because nothing really happened. This deposition was sufficient for a judge to order a hearing to consider a new trial for Fuster, with plans for Ileana to testify remotely. However, shortly after, Reverend Tommy Watson, the minister of Ileana's new church, which had helped negotiate her early release and was funding her education, flew to Honduras to meet with her. Following this meeting, Ileana signed a letter recanting her previous denial, a move witnessed by Watson, which effectively prevented the hearing that Fuster's attorney were trying to arrange. In a 2001 Frontline interview, Ileana claimed that Watson had threatened her into signing the letter. Frontline producer and director Michael Kirk commented on Ileana's conflicting statements, noting, "The question to me is not whether Ileana is a liar. Ileana is a liar. The only question is when she pled guilty or now."
I mean,
this is so fucking back and forth and back and forth. Yeah.
We're finishing up on this one, but I'll save my comment toward it. But this is, I can see why Frank lost everywhere.
As of 2020, Frank Fuster continues to serve a 165-year prison sentence. He and his defense team have claimed that he rejected a plea bargain that would have given him a 15-year sentence, allowing for an earlier release. Despite numerous appeals and requests for clemency, all efforts have been unsuccessful, and Fuster has been without legal representation since 2003. In 2012, the Innocence Project declined to take on his case, stating only that they could not accept it without providing further explanation. Fuster would not be eligible for parole until 2134. Where he will be long dead.
So, yeah, I hear he'll be dead.
During his time in prison, he's been attacked 5 times, including a serious incident where a fellow inmate stabbed him in the neck. Unfortunately, it didn't kill him.
My personal opinion, I think Frank Foster is guilty.
Oh, I think he is too. I think this is the one during the Satanic Panic of all of this that it's actually a guilty thing.
Whether his change of personality was due to him getting shot in the head or whatever, we won't really know. I think in this case, because there were a few other cases, Jan and Reno also tried to prosecute that were child abuse in daycares. Almost all of them were overturned on appeal because of that same reason. There a lot of coercive tactics were used to get confessions from or testimony from witnesses. But in this case, I think this is a case of, I feel, accidental justice. Frank Foster was probably guilty, in my opinion. Unfortunately, if this had been done today, he would have been let go because
all the evidence is circumstantial.
It's circumstantial. Yeah. Very clearly, I can tell his defense team didn't give a shit. I wouldn't even be surprised if they weren't just your regular public defenders who just
rolled. I'm sure
they just picked it, and they didn't want the case. They probably, like you said, they probably saw him and look, yeah, you're guilty as fuck. I don't want to defend you. And the only person who seemed to actually give something of a damn was the defense investigator.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I like to think he probably was only pushing that hard because it was a matter of principle. I mean, as for his wife, I don't know what her deal is. I think she's fucked up in the head that she doesn't know which way up is down, down is green. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, Peter Ellis. Peter Ellis was the eldest of 4 children. Born to parents who were both teachers. His parents separated when he was 9 years old. After leaving school in 1975, Ellis took up tobacco picking in Montequa.
Also, just to let you all know, this is in New Zealand. We are going international and to Middle Earth.
Yeah, we are going to the shithole of the world. One of the shitholes.
Pretty shithole.
Yeah. Following 2 years of travel overseas, he returned to New Zealand and found part-time work in a bakery during the 1980s. Which eventually became a full-time position. However, after leaving this job and applying for unemployment benefits, authorities discovered that he had received dole payments to which he was not entitled. In 1986, Ellis was prosecuted and convicted for misleading a social welfare officer and was sentenced to 80 hours of community service.
Also, if anyone doesn't know, dole is welfare. That's a short term and other English-speaking parts of the world for welfare.
Ellis completed his community service at the Christchurch Civic Creche. His supervisor, Dora Renfield, later noted that Ellis provided entertaining puppetry shows, one of which had to be stopped because both staff and children became overly excited. Renfield's subsequent monthly report praised Ellis, stating that it is New Zealand. They don't know how to speak English. He fitted in extremely well and put lots of energy into program planning and highlighted his fantastic team spirit. A pre-sentencing report on Ellis described him as an outgoing, uninhibited, unconventional person with a tendency to pour enthusiasm and energy into his work and social activities, sometimes to the point of being risque and outrageous. Before his imprisonment, Ellis had relationships with both men and women lasting between 2 and 5 years. He explained to author Lindley Hood that in relationships with women, he considered himself bisexual, whereas with men, he was monogamous. Hood described Ellis as appearing blatantly homosexual, noting his bright clothing, long hair, makeup, and overall demeanor. Ellis loved animals and kept rabbits, cats, and dogs as pets. In late September 1991, the mother of a 4-year-old boy at the creche, a social worker who had herself recovered memories of sexual abuse, bought a black puppy from him. Ella showed her son how to identify the puppy's gender. A few months later, in November 1991, the mother alleged that her son said he didn't like Peter's black penis. His mother, who had written a handbook on sexual abuse, concluded that her son had been sexually abused. She had made a formal complaint to the creche in November 1991. After a brief investigation, the police decided that there was no case to answer, but Ellis had already been suspended from work. The mother then withdrew her son from the creche and enrolled him in a different Christchurch daycare center. Shortly thereafter, she alleged a male worker at the second creche also had abused her son. Police investigated and again found no evidence to support the allegation. Ellis was popular with children and parents at the creche. In the week following his November 1991 suspension, inspectors from the Education Review Office spent a week at the Civic Creche observing its daily operation. The office subsequently issued a favorable report stating that the staff ensure personal needs are met with warmth, care, and consideration, and that the children appear happy, inquisitive, and sociable, and have high self-esteem. Sounds like that woman's just in it to get some money.
Probably, and we're going to see that that may there may be something to that allegation. Honestly, for someone who supposedly wrote a book on sexual abuse, it's like, you don't seem to be very good at spotting it, because literally the cops investigated twice, and it's like, nothing
there. Even though police concluded no abuse had occurred, some parents started asking their children about what went on at the creche and then shared these stories with other parents. The Department of Social Welfare was called in to conduct formal interviews with many of these children. A social welfare psychologist, Sue Seide, initially revealed that there were six children for whom she felt there were grounds for concern. Although the children made no disclosures of any incident or any indecent touching by a creche staff member, more parents became concerned that something must have happened as the social welfare interviews continued. Claims about bizarre sexual abuse incidents began to surface. A meeting was held at the creche attended by staff members, a group of concerned parents, and representatives from the social welfare department. In response, the police reopened their investigation. Altogether, at least 127 children were interviewed. Some detectives believe that up to 80 had been abused. Ellis was accused, among other things, of sodomizing children, forcing them to eat his feces, urinating on them, suspending them in cages, taking them on terrifying trips of abuse through tunnels, ceilings, and trapdoors. Sure this isn't R. Kelly?
Or P. Diddy.
Yeah. Other allegations included children being forced in a steaming hot oven or buried in coffins. One boy claimed he had his belly button removed with pliers. Pretty sure that's easily solved.
I'm pretty sure the cop could have figured that out. Nope, still there.
Exactly. But it was an Audi first.
That's what I was going to say. Maybe it was an Audi. Yeah. And it went to be an innie.
One boy, allegations which emerged later as the interviews progressed included Asian men dressed as cowboys, Masonic lodges, cemeteries, the Park Royal Hotel, and private houses far from the creche, and the notorious Circle incident where Ellis and his co-workers supposedly took a group of children to 404 Hereford Street on the other side of town and made them stand naked and kick each other while the adults danced around them. Alleged by one parent was a sacrifice of a boy called Andrew. No child was actually reported missing by anyone involved. The allegations were similar to those made in other satanic ritual abuse cases.
I bet you any money this is where the parents are probably watching TV of stuff going down in America and England, because England had their own fair share of the satanic daycares cases as well. And they're thinking, oh, I can do something with that too.
Yeah. On March 30th, 1992, I was 10 days old. How old were you, Ben? Hold on. He's got to do the math.
Four.
I was 10 days old.
I was one and a couple months.
Oh, thanks.
Peter Ellis was arrested and charged with the first of what would eventually be 45 counts of sexually abusing 20 different children at the Christchurch Civic Creche. By the time the case went to trial, the Crown had reduced the number of charges to 28, involving 13 complainants. The Crown is their court in New Zealand and Australia.
Because they have, the Kiwis haven't thrown off the shackles of British imperialism. Yeah, I said what I said.
I mean, there is a reason, like, Hawaii's flag is the way it is.
Yeah, well, that's only because they were originally discovered. Yeah. I'm using air quotes. They really weren't discovered. The first Europeans to show up were the British.
Yeah, that's if you look, why. They have their flag, like the upper corner of the flag looks like the Union Jack.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, Captain Cook was actually killed by the Native Hawaiians because he tried to kidnap one of their elders.
Yeah. Don't kidnap a Hawaiian.
Yeah, that's the moral of the story.
How about this? Just don't kidnap anyone.
I don't know. Have you tried? You're trying to tango with them Polynesian ladies, the older ladies. They're nasty.
The aunties.
Yeah, the aunties.
I would not mess with aunties, grandmas, nothing like that.
Yeah.
In addition to the interviews conducted by social welfare psychologist Sue Seide, the Christchurch City Council, which owned the creche, requested a review of the management practices at the creche by psychologist and sex therapist Rosemary Smart. Let's just put a sex therapist in there. Yeah. Although Smart's report was completed in July 1992, nearly a year before Ellis's trial, it appeared to assume his guilt. While the word alleged was occasionally used, journalist Kate Brett observed that the report read as if the abuse had indeed occurred and Ellis had already been convicted. Smart also suggested that female staff members might have been involved in the abuse and cited research by sociologist David Finkelhor, whose book, Nursery Crimes, had influenced American believers in ritual abuse at daycares. Finkelhor's work has since been discredited. What a Finkelhor.
I'm sure.
I wonder if that's how you have to pronounce it.
Probably not, but that's the way I'm pronouncing it. David Finkelhor.
I mean, who cares? The guy wrote a book that full of bullshit.
Yeah. Following the completion of Smart's report in July 1992, a copy was provided to the police. Detectives indicated that the report played a crucial role in their decision to investigate four of Ellis's female colleagues at the creche. Their homes were searched for evidence ranging from pornography to the remains of babies, but nothing was found. Surprise, surprise. In September 1992, the Ministry of Education suspended the creche's license, leading to its closure. On October 1st, 1992, the four female staff members were arrested amidst considerable media attention. They faced 15 charges, including sexual violation, indecent assault, and performing an indecent act, having sex with Ellis, in a public place. However, Judge Williamson later discharged them, citing the insufficient weight of the evidence against them and the likelihood that their association with Ellis would prejudice their chances of a fair trial. Although the charges were dropped, the careers of these women were irreparably damaged. In March 1995, the four female employees, along with six other former staff members who had lost their jobs, were awarded $1 million by the employment court for unjustified dismissal. However, in September 1996, the Court of Appeal reduced this amount to $80,000, which was insufficient for some staff to recover their legal costs.
What a bunch of dicks. Yeah, I know. We falsely accuse you of crimes. Here's $1 million. Oh,
actually, no. We're going to take all of that back. You only get $80,000.
That is, I would have, you know what I would have done if I grabbed that money? I would have been like,
I would have disappeared. I'm going to America.
Pretty much. Try and take my money from me.
I'm going to America. Or I'm going someplace that has non-extradition trees.
I mean, what are these New Zealands going to do? They're going to show up. They're going to be like that.
Get on their ships and
sail.
Get on their sailboats, yeah. Like Moana.
Oh my God.
They're just rowing. We're going to get them. How far I'll go.
Get my money that I legally gave to somebody.
Peter Ellis was represented by barristers Rob Harrison and Siobhan McNulty. Siobhan?
Yeah.
Very Irish.
Oh, yeah.
Siobhan is very Irish. And the Mick in it, she's either Irish or Scottish.
The Mick would probably be, the MC would probably be Irish.
But yeah, Siobhan. Or Siobhan. It's Siobhan.
Siobhan.
It depends on... Because you can pronounce it different ways. It depends on the way they...
One of our Irish listeners, please send us a recording of how it's properly...
Well, everybody does it different. Like, it's spelled the same way, but some people say Siobhan, some people say Siobhan.
Do we have any listeners in New Zealand?
I don't know.
We'll have to look that up later.
While the crown was represented by Brent Stanaway and Chris Lange, the alleged offenses were said to have taken place at unspecified times between May 1st, 1986, 4 months before Ellis began working at the creche, and October 1st, 1992, 11 months after he left the creche and a month after it was closed. Defense counsel Rob Harrison wanted the jury to view the children's videotaped testimony, which contained bizarre allegations, believing that these would cast reasonable doubt on the more credible testimony. However, Justice Williamson ruled that these tapes were not relevant to the case. Okay. Is that, that part of the case?
Yeah, I agree.
Well, we know New Zealanders don't have high education, so...
Oh my God, a judge made a bad call in a trial.
Psychiatrist Karen Zelos, who was the prosecution's expert witness, also supervised the social workers conducting the children's interviews and advised the police on how to conduct their investigation. She testified that the complainants were credible and that their behavior was consistent with sexual abuse.
Oh, no shit, she said that. She's getting her paycheck from the state.
However, in August 1992, she had written to the police expressing concerns that two of the complainants had undergone highly leading questioning by their parents. This letter was not disclosed to Ellis's defense, and Zelos did not raise concerns about the two children's credibility during the trial. And that should be a mistrial, because you did not put in evidence.
Now, I'll grant you that I'm going to say this is the British court system, because New Zealand, their system is the same, is the exact same as the British. The British justice system is different from America, but it's close enough that the procedures are the same thing. So yeah, they have mistrials. This should have been.
I just imagine a big like New Zealander with the white fucking
the big tatted up Maori guy. He's like, yeah, you're in.
And he's got the huge white hair on. Psychiatrist and defense expert Keith LePage countered Zelos' testimony, stating that none of the behaviors described by Zelos were specific to sexual abuse. LePage noted that in his experience, both children and adults who had been abused typically expressed distress when recounting their experiences. However, the complainants in this case show little or no distress when describing acts of abuse during their interviews and when testifying in court. LePage also testified that children generally cannot remember events that occurred at a very young age, especially when there is a long delay between the event and the attempt to recall it. The alleged abuse at the creche had reportedly occurred when the children were very young. In June 1993, Peter Ellis was convicted of 16 counts of sexual offenses involving 7 children. The charges for which he was found guilty included urinating on 2 children, making one child masturbate him, putting his penis in the mouths of 3 children, engaging in indecent touching of 3 children, and putting his penis or an unknown associate's penis against the vagina or anus of 3 children. The following year, Ellis was acquitted of 3 charges involving the oldest complainant, who retracted her allegations and stated that her original statement was what her mother told her to say.
Which I guarantee you all the other complaints are just about the same thing.
Yeah.
Just telling them, like, because again, kids are very impressionable and they can pick up on the subtle emotions of the adult. If the adults want them to say this, they're going to do it to please them because you want to make mom and dad happy.
Yeah. Throughout his time at the Paparua prison, Ellis was not subjected to mistreatment by staff or inmates. Corrections officers who had attended his trial did not believe he was guilty and made this known in the prison. Ellis refused to attend parole board hearings while incarcerated because he would have to confess to the crimes in order to argue for early release.
This surprised me. I've never heard of guards going to there. I mean, granted, New Zealand's a fairly small country in terms of population, but still. But that's actually, there's very little lining on this, but this is probably one of the few where, yeah, he went to prison, but at least nobody was doing what they usually do, because New Zealand prisons are pretty bad. Yeah, especially because I saw a documentary about some of the hardcore Maori biker gangs that are there. They give the Hells Angels a run for their money.
Yeah. The case against Peter Ellis occurred during a period marked by widespread moral panic surrounding child sexual abuse and satanic ritual abuse, both in New Zealand and internationally. In the years leading up to the first allegation against Ellis, Christchurch had seen a number of high-profile child abuse cases that involved questionable interviews with children, mistaken diagnosis, and other dubious claims. This atmosphere of heightened fear and suspicion contributed to what many believe was a climate ripe for the kind of hysteria that surrounded the Ellis case. The Ellis case has been linked to the broader day care, sex abuse hysteria, moral panic that began in California in 1982, as we talked about, and spread throughout the 1980s. This panic was characterized by unfounded allegations of sexual abuse and satanic rituals in daycare centers, which led to numerous investigations and wrongful convictions. The Ellis case has also been cited as a significant factor in the decline of male teachers in New Zealand schools, as the fear of false allegations made the profession increasingly unattractive to men. Starting in September 1991, just 2 months before the first allegation against Ellis, there was continuous media coverage in New Zealand about sexual and ritual abuse of children. On September 4th, 1991, a Wellington sex abuse counselor, Anne Marie Stapp, told the press that New Zealand was approaching the same level of ritual abuse awareness as the United States. At the time, rumors circulated in Christchurch about a supposed pornography pedophile ring involving judges, Freemasons, and prominent businessmen, although such a ring was never found.
Of course not.
On November 3rd, 1991, the Sunday News quoted police as saying that Satanism was rampant in New Zealand and linked to child pornography. 17 days later, the first complaint against Peter Ellis was made by a Christchurch mother when Ellis's former lawyer, Nigel Hampton QC, announced Ellis's appeal to the Supreme Court in July 2019. He argued that the moral panic in the 1990s should be considered in the court's decision-making process.
Freaking Middle Earth, man.
Yeah. So the reliability of the evidence against Ellis has been heavily criticized, particularly the process used to interview the children. As part of the second investigation into allegations of sexual abuse, at least 118 children were interviewed, mostly by social welfare psychologist Sue Seide, who had no formal qualifications in child psychology. In December 1991, Seide conducted interviews that did not yield any statements consistent with abuse. Despite this, she declared that Peter Ellis is not a suitable person for a child center before any former allegations of abuse had been made.
Wow.
As more parents became concerned, some children were interviewed up to six times, and their stories began to include increasingly bizarre allegations. These stories were rarely challenged, even when the children's answers were inconsistent or incoherent. Interviewers often repeated questions in more elaborate forms until they obtained the desired answers. This approach contradicted best practice guidelines, which emphasized the importance of avoiding suggestive questioning. So the way that you're told to interview everybody, not just children, but to avoid suggestive is, can you kind of leave it open-ended? Can you tell me what happened on this night? Instead of saying, well, did Mr. Ellis touch you with his hand on your vagina? Then the kid, yeah, he did. But if I say, oh, what happened that night? Well, nothing happened. You're not supposed to do that unless you have overwhelming evidence and you know that this has happened. If I have overwhelming evidence, I'm not going to question the witnesses that way. I'm going to question the suspect that way. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Hey, did you do this? Because I know the answers. And that's what I used to tell people all the time. Just remember, when I'm asking these questions, I know the answers. Just saying if you want to tell me the right answer.
Yeah. That's why, folks, whenever you're interviewed for the police, unless you are literally giving a statement because someone snatched your purse, ask for a lawyer.
Exactly.
You will never, I repeat this, you will never outsmart the detective. That is only in the movies. Nobody's ever that smart.
Nope. And so always, always, always have a lawyer present when questioned, no matter what, no matter who you're questioned by. Now, don't be an asshole and make it difficult, but be questioned with a lawyer present. Don't try and say, sovereign citizen bullshit, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, no. We don't advocate for that.
You're a sovereign citizen, you're a fucking piece of shit and you deserve to die.
Yes.
I hate sovereign citizens.
You keep filling TikTok and other social media up with your shenanigans. Nobody cares.
I have dealt with way too many sovereign citizens, and I've wanted to punch them in the face so many times. I pray that they don't listen to me so I could tase them.
I'm very happy in my years as military police. I never ran into those kind of people. Yeah. Pam and I never ran into them, and I just thank every day for that.
Florida was full of soft sits and still is. So the interviewers also failed to check whether the children had been influenced by conversation with their parents or others, which could lead to contamination of their memories. In one instance, a mother admitted in court that she encouraged her son to provide new information by cuddling him, praising him, and telling him how brave he was each time he revealed more details of his alleged abuse. You know, talk about gaslighting.
Good Lord. Well,
that could be she wanted to be with him, and he's just like, no. So,
again, children are, children, especially young children, want to please mom and dad because
trust me, I had to be very careful of what I said with my baby brother. Because if I said, I hate, let's say, broccoli. He loved broccoli. I didn't like broccoli. All of a sudden, he would not eat broccoli.
Because he wants to make you happy because you don't like it.
Exactly.
I used to like bell peppers when I was younger. I used to eat them like crazy. And my grandmother one time said, I don't know how you eat those things. I took another bite. And I did not like them anymore.
Yeah.
And I still don't like them unless they're mixed and stuff.
Sloppy Joes. I would not eat Sloppy Joes for the longest time because they did not taste like my Nana's.
Yeah. Kids are
so what my Nana would do was put my food and her food on the same plate. So I would eat at least my veggies.
Yeah.
Off of her plate because it tasted so much better off of her plate.
Kids are very impressionable and they want to please the adults because if they're happy, we're all happy. I get a treat. I get a present. Whatever that goes through a kid's mind, but we don't want to be. No kid wants to be around upset adults. At least not till teenage years, and then they don't give a shit anyways.
Yeah. So, Michael Lamb, a leading authority on child abuse interviews, reviewed the process used in the Ellis case. He noted that the delays between the alleged events and the formal interviews, some conducted up to 18 months later. And this right here, so you have different interview periods. The first 24 hours is critical in interviewing somebody. That is when memories are the most fresh. And then you're supposed to interview them immediately, and then you interview them 24 hours later, because sometimes that adrenaline kicks off and you start remembering other things that you think you didn't see, so you interview them again. And typically, you interview 3 to 4 times over a week to start to get that information. But 18 months, especially to children, they're going to forget everything that happened.
With the case that I was a victim in, I was interviewed 24, 48, or 36 hours after the initial one, and then I got home, and 2 weeks later, I was re-interviewed.
Yeah.
So I was interviewed at least 4 or 5 times, and each time it was by different people.
And there's also a reason that, a cop will show up to a place, and I'll pull aside somebody, and let's say Ben's my partner. He'll pull aside the other party. We'll do interviews, and then we'll switch, and we'll ask the same exact questions. And then we come back together and we compare notes and go, okay, this person said this to me. Did they say this to you? Mm-hmm. And consistency, because what I tell everybody, there are 3 sides to every story. There is the plaintiff side, there's the defendant side, and then there's the truth.
Yep.
And it's always somewhere in between.
Because eventually you just start convincing yourself, especially for long periods of time, of what is the truth. And especially with these kids, like the doctor said, they just start absorbing information from elsewhere. And then after a while, they think and they marinate. Next thing you know, it's always been there.
Yeah.
When it really wasn't. So, and now we're going to get into what I think was one of the initial spurring of these allegations.
So Stephen J. Sesse, a psychologist at Cornell and an expert in children's suggestibility, also studied the interview transcripts. In 1995, he concluded that the interviews were not conducted in accordance with currently understood interviewing principles. Sesse emphasized that the children are repeatedly and suggestively interviewed over a long period, and it becomes impossible to distinguish between accurate and inaccurate allegations.
Here's the heart of a part of the heart of the matter.
Ellis's sexuality played a significant role in his prosecution and conviction. As the only male worker at the crash and an openly homosexual man, Ellis was portrayed during the trial as sexually deviant and perverted, traits that were wrongly associated with the profile of a child molester. Many people involved in the case believe that Ellis's homosexuality contributed to the prejudices against him and ultimately led to his conviction. The case highlighted the stigmatization of homosexuality in the context of child abuse allegations during a time of moral panic.
And this is what I feel really tainted everybody, because he's a flamboyant gay man working around kids.
Yeah.
And this is during the time that
you
didn't really want to have your sexuality out.
Well, actually, in the 80s, in this time in the 80s, it was actually a time when homosexuals were coming out all over the world, but you still had a very large part of the population.
And he literally lives in a place called Christchurch.
Yeah. There's a little large part of society and all over the world, especially the English-speaking world, that this is not okay. Homosexuality is not okay, but Peter Ellis is a very proud gay man, but everyone loves him, but obviously the parents don't love him because, again,
he's going to make our children gay. And that's what it was.
Wouldn't be surprised if someone had that attitude.
For those of you that did not live during the 80s and 90s that are in the LGBTQ world, like, obviously, everybody knows you have support with us. We support all of you guys, but you would not have liked it back then, back when we were growing up. I'll tell you, if I would have came out as gay to my family, they would have disowned me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, back then it was hard time being gay or bisexual or transgender. It was really hard. Nowadays,
it's still hard.
There's always going to be still people out there who are assholes and small-minded and everything. But by and large, you know what? I don't want to say nobody cares.
What you do.
Yeah, like, it's a normal part of society. Back then, the LGBTQ community was very much on the outside.
And that, honestly, that's how I am. As long as whoever you are and whatever you do does not affect me in a negative way, I do not care what you do or who you are.
Yep.
Now, if you're coming over to me and you are trying to, like, turn me into a homosexual or whatever, then we've got an issue. Or if you are affecting my livelihood by what you are doing, then we have an issue. But other than that, do what you want. Be happy. That's all that matters.
And here's now we're getting into another motivator behind this too.
So the involvement of New Zealand's Accident Compensation Corporation, ACC, in the Peter Ellis case has been a point of controversy. Malcolm Cox, a parent with three children at the Civic crash, suggested that some parents might have been motivated to make claims of sexual abuse because ACC automatically awarded $10,000 to anyone claiming to have been abused.
Jesus, that in 1980s, $10,000 is a lot of money.
Cox reported that Cox reported that he and his wife were visited by a council social worker who provided them with ACC claim forms and urged them to get in quick to claim the money because lump sums were being abolished. In total, ACC paid out more than $500,000 to about 40 parents of children who attended the Civic creche. Typically, parents received a standard payment of $10,000, but in cases where Ellis faced multiple charges related to a single child, some parents were able to claim for each alleged incident of the abuse. One set of parents reportedly claimed 5 payments, while another claimed 4. According to North and South magazine, ACC did not require conviction before paying out compensation. In fact, payments were made even in cases where no charges had been laid. The police even supported some of these compensation claims by writing letters to ACC.
So, I'm looking up right now, trying to, at least these charts don't go back very far, but essentially $10,000 in New Zealand dollars to the U.S. as of today is about $6,100 in American money. Now, that's today. I can only imagine it's probably worth a little bit more, given for inflation from the 80s to now. But yeah, this is a very significant payday for these parents. So I really feel like this was a major contributing factor. Well, I mean, well, I guess in the case, one factor led into another. I mean, you got a bunch of parents who probably don't like the fact that there's an openly homosexual man or bisexual. He was admittedly mostly homosexual. I say a little bit bisexual. Working with their kids, and so they probably felt very little guilt about accusing him of whatever these crimes were in order to get a nice big chunk of a payday of $10,000.
Let's see, hold on. I found what it would have been.
Oh, how much money would these people have gotten? I imagine not much. I was actually shocked how...
So the equivalent in New Zealand is $58,000.
Oh.
And then... So that would have been $35,000 US.
So
$35,800.
Okay.
So each one of those was about $35,000 in equivalent to today's money. And they're claiming 4 or 5 times. Yeah, so
that's probably enough for a house back then.
Oh yeah, easily. I mean, 35 times 5. I mean, you're looking at over $100,000.
Yeah,
that's in the '80s. That's more than enough to buy a house. I mean, in the '80s, you could buy a house for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 easily.
Yeah,
depending on where you were. So several irregularities during the trial were brought to light in a 2020 television episode that aired on TV3 on November 16, 1997. One major concern was that the jury foreman had been the celebrant at Crown Prosecutor Brent Stanaway's wedding 15 years earlier, raising questions about potential bias. Additionally, it was alleged that a female juror had sexual relationship with a co-worker of the mother of one of the children involved in the case. It's a little bit of a stretch, but New Zealand's not that big.
Yeah.
The program also highlighted that many of the children who initially made allegations of sexual abuse later withdrew their accusations. However, the social workers conducting the interviews interpreted these retractions as a symptom of denial rather than considering the possibility that the allegations might have been unfounded.
I feel like that's a little bit of a cover your ass on the social workers, because again, these were the people who would have been interviewing these kids.
Yeah. The 2020 program further revealed issues with lead investigating detective Colin Eady, who had history of mental health problems.
This one threw me. I couldn't wrap my head around this one.
In an interview with Melanie Reed, Eady admitted that he was burnt out even before the case began and was beyond repair by the time it ended. Eady left the police force in 1994, suffering from PTSD. He also confessed in a Radio New Zealand interview with Sean Plunkett on November 20, 1997, that after the trial, he had sexual relationships with 2 of the mothers involved in the case and a proposition another mother during the investigation while he was intoxicated.
I really want to know what the hell is going on in New Zealand that one of the cops is burnt out and beyond repair.
Well, it's New Zealand.
It's not that bad.
It's a penal. It's just like Australia. It's
actually
a penal.
No, it really wasn't. New Zealand wasn't a penal colony. I know, yeah,
but they're all the same. New Zealanders and Australians are all the same.
To our listeners, if we have any in Australia,
we
New
do.
Zealand,
we do in Australia.
To the Australian ones, we're sorry for
confusing. We're not sorry.
Okay.
Well, not to the Australians. Maybe to the New Zealanders, but to the Australians. Actually, they know they live in a penal colony. After
Australia's dreadful performance in the Olympics, you guys, sorry.
Listen, if your police investigate like your dancers breakdance at the Olympics, we got some big issues. Especially from a former dancer, you got some issues. New Zealand first MP Raina Waitai, a former police commander with 31 years of experience, reacted strongly to these revelations. Waitai stated, if half of what was on the 2020 program is true, Peter Ellis must immediately be released and hugely compensated for the devastation that has been done to his life. These revelations added to the growing doubts about the fairness of Ellis's trial and the legitimacy of the convictions. Now, the first appeal in Peter Ellis's case was brought before the Court of Appeal in July 1994, led by Graham Pankhurst QC. And QC is would be the equivalent of Esquire for us.
I believe
it's the equivalent of Esquire. A significant aspect of the appeal was the fact that the seven children whose evidence led to Ellis's conviction had named 21 other children as either observers or participants in the alleged abuse. However, none of those 21 children corroborated the allegations. On the fourth day of the hearing, the oldest child whose testimony was crucial to Ellis's conviction and considered one of the most credible witnesses told her parents that her story was not true. She admitted that she had only said what she believed her parents and the interviewer wanted to hear. Despite this retraction, the Court of Appeals consider it not uncommon for child complainants to withdraw their allegations. The appellate judges concluded that the retraction might have been a case of denial and was only sufficient to overturn the convictions related to that specific child. The child has since maintained that her allegations were fabricated and that no abuse occurred. Her family has alleged that they were pressured by police and the Crown Prosecutor in an unprofessional manner, and noted that the Ministry of Justice has never contacted them about their daughter's retraction.
This is also why I feel like Peter Ellis never really got the justice, because New Zealand is not the United States, where in a sense of, like, if there's impropriety,
it's thrown out. And
well, in the sense of, like, this is what they call saving face. There's the U.S. judicial system is so huge in comparison to, compared to the United States, that if there's impropriety on the count of, like, say, a judge did something horrible in California, you know, there's no shame. The shame doesn't touch, like, say, a judge in Florida.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing. It's different jurisdictions, different everything. Christchurch. New Zealand is literally just two islands. This is a small judicial system. All these judges, I guarantee you, probably know each other to one extent or another. So this is a case of everyone's trying to save face, cover their ass, and it's like, well, just because she retracted her story doesn't mean the others aren't true. I'm like, come on, man, what are you doing?
Yeah,
this was a bogus case from the word go, and you're still trying to hold it all up. It's like, come on, just admit, take the loss, and let the man go.
In November 1998, Ellis submitted a second petition to the Governor General, seeking a Royal Commission of Inquiry into his case, a free pardon, or the entire case to be referred back to the Court of Appeal. Secretary for Justice sought advice from Sir Thomas Thorpe, who recommended expanding the terms of reference. In 1999, the Ellis case was referred to the Court of Appeal for a second time. Judith Ablett Kerr, QC, represented Ellis, while Simon France represented the Crown. Ablett Kerr argued that the children's evidence had been contaminated by parental questioning, and highlighted the dangers of multiple interviews, the use of anatomically correct dolls, and suggestive questioning. Barry Parsonson, the former head of the New Zealand Psychologist Board, was asked to review the process used to interview the children. He concluded that given the prevailing conditions, the level of parental contamination, and the highly suggestive interviewing procedures, that the probability of fact outweighing fiction in the children's testimony was very, very small indeed. The Crown presented the expert opinion to Constance Dallenberg. Ultimately, the Court of Appeal concluded that they were not persuaded that a miscarriage of justice had occurred, but suggested that a Royal Commission of Inquiry could better examine some of the issues raised. Ellis immediately submitted a third petition to the Governor General. In 1999, the Ministry of Justice commissioned retired High Court Judge Sir Thomas Thorpe to examine a petition for the Royal Prerogative of Mercy lodged by Ellis's counsel, Judith Ablett Kerr, QC. Despite being based on selective information, the reports presented by Ablett Kerr raised serious concerns for Thorpe, who believed they warranted further investigation. Finally, somebody was doing something right.
Yeah.
Thorpe noted that the interview transcripts revealed instances where one child claimed to have witnessed serious abuse against another child, only for the second child to deny that anything had happened. He expressed concern that the interviewers, police, and prosecutors had not conducted proper cross-checking before presenting the allegations to the jury. Thorpe argued that the exclusion of the more bizarre allegations from the trial was problematic because the jury needed to see the full context of the children's capabilities for making outrageous and fanciful claims. Thorpe's central concerns were the claims of defective interviewing techniques, the risk of contamination of the children's evidence, and the exclusion of evidence necessary to properly assess the children's reliability. He suggested that if the opinions of experts like Barry Parsonson, Stephen Sesse, and Justice Wood were found to have substantial support, it would be difficult to argue against the existence of serious doubts about the safety of Ellis's convictions. In March 2000, then Minister of Justice Phil Goff established a ministerial inquiry into the conduct of the interviews headed by Sir Thomas Eichelbaum. This inquiry was initiated in response to Justice Thorpe's report and ongoing concerns about the reliability of the children's evidence. The inquiry was intended to address specific concerns of specific areas of concern that might not have been fully resolved by the Court of Appeal. The terms of reference required by Eichelbaum to examine the relevant documents and seek written submissions from those involved in the case, but he was not permitted to conduct interviews. He was also instructed to appoint two international experts to provide witness reviews of the interviewing techniques used with the children. Eichelbaum selected Graham Davies from the University of Leicester and Louise Soss from London, Ontario, Canada. Well, that's one issue. In his evaluation, Davies declined to comment on the reliability of individual children's accounts, while psychologist Michael Corbalis of Auckland University later questioned the credentials of both experts, particularly Sass. The Eichelbaum inquiry released on March 2001 concluded that the interviews were of good quality overall, although excessive questioning by some parents may have led to some contamination. Eichelbaum concluded that this would not have been sufficient to affect the convictions. However, the inquiry did not provide detailed reasoning on how children's evidence was determined to be reliable, leaving some questions unanswered. After his release from prison, Peter Ellis led an isolated life, choosing to settle with the small community of Lythefield Beach in North Canterbury. In July 2019, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. Despite his ongoing legal battle to clear his name, he passed away on September 4th, 2019 at the age of 61 while still appealing his conviction. Honestly, they need to posthumously overturn it.
Yeah.
I think there is still a bit of a movement on the lawyers and some of the his surviving family, but the New Zealand Court of Appeals isn't really, like, in a hurry to do it. Yeah. That is
Satanic Panic Part 2. So Part 3 is going to be a lot of, like, the Pokemon and D&D and that kind of stuff. 4 will carry over a lot of that stuff, and then the end of 4 will lead into Boys on the Tracks, also known as the West Memphis 3. And then we'll be doing that the following week, and then we'll be hitting a few other things, and then in October we're doing some hauntings for Halloween, so that'll be fun.
No, it won't.
Especially the RMS Queen Mary.
Oh, that one's... I've read and watched a lot of stuff on the... It is so fucking creepy.
Is the inspiration for the movie Ghost Ship.
Great movie.
No.
Very good movies. Best opening scene of all time. The sink. Cutting off all the heads and the girls just standing there like this.
Kate, final thoughts on Frank Fuster and Peter Ellis?
Frank Fuster actually did it.
Yeah.
Frank Fuster is a piece of shit and deserves to be shanked in prison and raped slowly.
Which apparently is already happening.
Yeah. So, which he's getting what he deserves. He should be sodomized.
Yeah.
But Ellis is completely innocent.
I agree.
There is no physical evidence, and we've never seen that they did any kind of rape kits. They did not do any of that because they did this 18 months later. If you would have done this immediately, you could have done rape. Rape kits existed in the 90s, 80s and 90s. Yep.
They weren't as sufficient as they were now, but they did exist.
So you could have done rape kits. You could have done everything. And did this daycare not have, I mean, cameras existed in the 80s and 90s. Did this daycare not have cameras?
I mean, probably not. This was a city-owned
Which would facility. Make it seem that it should have cameras even more because it's city-owned.
Yeah.
They have city money to do the cameras.
I've always felt, just from things that I've seen about New Zealand, the people who live there, they
don't care about people.
It's not that they don't care about people. They live under the false assumption, and I'm sure it was more so back then, that they are... The world's problems aren't there. New Zealand is different. We're this wonderful, happy little community.
Yeah, how'd that work out?
Yeah, it really didn't work out. But
yeah, I just I think Peter Ellis was wrongly convicted, and I think he should not have spent all that time in prison. I think whatever family has should be compensated if they posthumously clear him. Unfortunately, he did die of cancer, which is sad.
Yeah. It was terminal bladder cancer.
You do not recover from bladder cancer.
As far as I can tell, the government never compensated him, other than just getting him released fairly earlier than he was supposed to. But as I was saying before, I really feel like the New Zealand justice system is so small that nobody wants to admit to this miscarriage of justice because this is something that affects them all.
Yeah.
And like I was saying to Kate, it was in America, if there's an impropriety on one side of the country, the other side of the country probably neither knows nor cares about it because it's essentially another world away. But in New Zealand, they literally have two big islands and maybe one city, I'm using air quotes on that, on each island. So this is, while it is not a small country in terms of population, it is small in the sense that they're something like the court system is probably very small.
I mean, New Zealand makes Hawaii look big.
Exactly. In terms of population.
Yeah.
So if Judge Snuffy was making some very ethical concerns, all the other judges would probably feel inclined to close ranks around him because it's like, hey, this is our friend. That's my opinion. I think the New Zealand government should again at least issue an apology, compensate his family because they stole however many years away from them, Peter, from them.
Yeah. So. That wraps up part two. Join us next week for part three. We want to thank you for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.